All right, so I'm reporting here on a joint project with Nora Gunter. This is joint with Nora from Melbourne. I think she should be around. She said she will be around. And as you can see from the title, it's about a link between different areas of mathematics or physics, less physics maybe, these codes and maybe infinite dimensional representation theory and topology. So this is what we are working on since recently, and I will report on that. And we'll start with codes now. Let me say what I mean by a monomial transformation. Let's assume K is a finite field. So K is a finite field. And then I mean by, what do I mean by a monomial transformation? It's just a linear map. If you think of matrices, you allow permutation matrices and you allow diagonal matrices with only units on the diagonal. Okay. Then a code is simply a subspace of K to the N. This would be a code of length N. We only consider linear codes, meaning really vector spaces at this point. A morphism between codes is a monomial transformation which takes one code to the other. In particular, you should recognize at this point that such a morphism doesn't need to move the points of a code, right? The elements of a code. For example, if you look at the case K equals the field with two elements, and you look at the zero code, then it still has automorphism. The automorphism group is a permutation group, the symmetric group in N letters then, okay? Here's another word that I need to introduce, the weight of a word. A word is just an element in the code, an element in this finite vector space. And the weight of the word is given by the numbers of letters, if you like, of digits, of letters, which are non-zero. Okay, here's an interesting example for a code, a very famous one. It's the Hamming code. It's a code of length N, and the field is the field with two elements, so it's a binary code. I have written down the code in terms of a picture. You can see here four circles. Well, the fourth one I probably have to draw still. This one which comprises the other. And the code is given by those elements in F2 to the A with a property whenever you sum over the digits which appear in the circle, that should be zero. So each circle gives you an equation. You have four equations here. And if the word is good, it's four equations in an eight-dimensional vector space, that should be F2 to the four, and it is. So it has 16 elements, this code. And I've written down only four of them here in the left lower corner. I mean the rows are the elements in the code. These are typical elements. This code has good properties. What do I mean by that? For example, it is self-dual, meaning if I take the usual product, the usual inner product, mod 2, then every word is perpendicular to any other word, including itself. And it is doubly even. What does that mean? It means that the minimum weight for all words, non-zero words, is 4. This has practical applications. So for example, suppose you are Alice and you want to send a message to Bob. Say you want to send this message here, for example. Maybe this one. Say you want to send this word to Bob. That can happen that there is Eve. Eve causes transmission errors. So it happens a mistake and you don't say this one is really a zero. You send a zero. Ben only hears the zero at this point. Then Ben still can, or Bob, I think it was Bob, right? Bob still can figure out which word was really meant, because any other word other than the original, the white one, is far away from that. Any other one differs in at least three spots, whereas the right word only differs in one spot, right? So it's a self-correcting code. That's what people like about it, about this one. You can send wrong words and you can still figure out what's the right one. So it's so what people in coding theory like to do, they try to find many words, but these words should be far away from each other according to the weight, right? The difference of any two codes consists of some ones, and if the minimum weight is 4, then so they differ in at least 4 spots. That's why this code is important, and it will play an important role later. That's why I'm doing this here. Here's an example of a ternary code. So here's a field, K is a field with 3 elements, and N is 4. It's a 4 a code of length 4. And I've written it down here in terms of, if you like, a parameterization. So immediately you can see this is a two-dimensional vector space. It has 9 elements, right? And one can just count the minimum weight. It is 3, so it's still error correcting. It's also self-dual. And another thing which is interesting about it is this automorphism group. You can just calculate it. It is GL2 of F3, which turns also ought to be the automorphism group of a certain elliptic curve. The elliptic curve is y squared plus y equals x cubed over F4. Over F4, you will find 9 pairs x and y, which satisfy this equation. And the automorphisms of this elliptic curve correspond with the automorphism of this code. Now, the question is, why is that so? Is there deeper? This curve you might have seen before, this is the Lubin-Tate curve, which is responsible for the maximal finite subgroup in the Morava stabilizer group. So what has a Morava stabilizer group to do with that thing? I'm going to say this is going to be a strange talk, but I'm a good company. I will probably ask more questions here than have answers, right? And but I'm a good company in this workshop. There had been talks like this before, so I don't feel bad about it. Here's another code. It's a very famous one. It's a Golay code. Here it has length 12 and it's self-dual, so it has 3 to the 6 words, 729 words. And its automorphism group is also very interesting. It's one of these sporadic groups. It's one of these module groups. It has about 200,000 elements. And as you can see, we start off with something very simple with only finite vector spaces. Yeah, very simple structure. But still, you come up with very interesting groups. I think that's really remarkable. And this is the basics of coding theory. Now, codes are very much related to lattices. So let me talk a little bit about lattices. I'm considering here the cyclotomic field K, which you get by adjoining a primitive root of P root of unity to the rational numbers. And in there, we have the ring of integers. Some people call these the Eisenstein integers. If you think of it, what it is, it's just you have to adjoin to the integers this root of unity. So we allow this root of unity and integers in Q zeta. By the way, it has rank, maybe you should say that. The rank of this is P minus 1. In O, I like to consider the principal ideal generated by 1 minus zeta. I will need this constantly, so I will give it a name. The sublattice of O, I will give a name. It is called, I will call it the Eisenstein ideal in this talk, because I don't think it has a name, so I will give it a name. All right. I want to consider it because I do have that exact sequence here available. If you divide out from all this ideal, this principal ideal, you get just FP. And the map, which I've written down here by row, just takes an element of the Eisenstein integers, considers as sum over the powers of zeta. I said the rank of O is p minus one, and this is really a basis, the powers of zeta. And you sum just up the coefficients of these. That's the map, and you check that the ideal p is just the kernel of this map rho, okay? It's just a small calculation. I try to make visible our lattice for the case p equals 3 below. So what you can see here is the unit circle. Oh, I'm not sure if this is working. Oh, wonderful. So this is the unit circle. So this is zeta, primitive third root, and this would be zeta bar, by the way. Zeta has the value 1 under rho, negative 1 has the value negative 1, and so on. So what these numbers underneath the points are just the values of rho. I try to group them to FP here with drawing a line. Okay. So this is the Eisenstein lattice, and now you can also see, of course, the sublattice O. So this Eisenstein ideal lattice in the color red. It's just the kernel of rho, so that's all it is. So you have a picture in mind of the lattice. Now, what is the link between codes and lattices, or at least one link? You can start, let me go back once more. You can start with this exact sequence and take it to the n. And if you have a code in FP to the n, well, here's the code now in there, flying in there. Then you can take its pre-image, then you get a sublattice of O. For example, if you take the zero code, you get the Eisenstein ID lattice P, right? Okay. This is the definition. For any code, you get a lattice this way. I'm going to define now a symmetric bilinear form on this lattice. I'm looking at the chat function. Nothing coming up. Just interrupt me if you feel like it. Okay, I'm going to define a bilinear form just because it will turn out to see nice properties of the code. That's why I'm considering it. So you will see that in a moment. The definition for x times y is you sum up over the trace of the usual products xi times y bar and you divide it by p. The trace is given by the sum over all embeddings of your cyclotomic field in the complex numbers. Not just because everything, oh, thanks very much. I mean here sigma is just the embedded, some sigma r is an embedding of your field in the complex numbers given by zeta goes to zeta to the r. And you sum over all embeddings, that's called the trace. It turns out this trace is a rational number. So this bilinear form takes values in the rationals and has the following properties. If you start with a code which is self-orthogonal, so every point in the C, every word is perpendicular to itself, then this lattice that you have produced is an even lattice. Of course, the rank n times p minus 1, I explained that. It's even means that it only takes values in the integers. So that's something really remarkable. That's why we did the symmetric bilinear form. And if you plug in the same value twice, you get an even integer. Moreover, if you look at the dual code, the code with so C perp and the lattice attached to that, then it is simply the dual lattice of the original lattice gamma C. The dual lattice is defined to be those Eisenstein integers which pair to integers under this symmetric product. So maybe I should also write, if you have a self-dual code, yes, that just means that you get a self-dual lattice. So gamma C is gamma C. It's just coming out of this, right? So the upshot is here, nice codes. It's not easy to produce such self-dual lattices. You will see that. So, but One way is just to take the code, which is self-dual. Self-dual code give us nice things like self-dual lattices. Now, I want to talk about an invariant which plays a role in this business to analyze all these objects. And I want to consider only the case P equals 3 for reason we can discuss later. Oh, you cannot see what I'm writing. Thank you for telling me that. I'm trying to fix this. Okay. I wanted to talk about the theta series at this point. If you have a lattice, you can look at the theta series, which means it is a function defined on the upper half plane, which you get by summing up all elements in the lattice and you sum up the expressions e to the pi I x squared tau. Now here's a theorem, which is sometimes called the Alpbach theorem. Alpbach is a small village in Austria, and Van der Geer and Hirzebruch, they had a seminar there, which I actually attended as a student. It was in the beginning of the 90s or late 80s. And they found a theorem. Here's a theorem, the theorem of Alpbach. The theorem says, why is it necessary to specialize to P equals 3? I come to this in a moment. So gamma C is a modular form for the group gamma 3. Gamma 3 is a subgroup of SL2Z of this matrix. It's a congruent subgroup. And modular form means that you have a function which is invariant under this Möbius transformation, invariant up to this factor at C tau plus D to the N. And it is holomorphic at infinity, meaning if you expand this expression as a Fourier series, then you have a holomorphic function in Q to the N. No singularities, so no negative coefficients. And self-dual codes give SL2Z invariant modular forms. So good codes give good modular forms which are invariant under the full group SL2Z. Now there is the question, why do they specialize to the case P equals 3? Actually, they don't. Only I did specialize. They have, the theorem is actually true for all primes, but you don't get a modular form. What you get is a Hilbert modular form. You don't have to work with one copy of the upper half plane, but with P minus 1/2 copies of the upper half plane. So you get a function in several variables, and it is still invariant under gamma P, where gamma P is a bigger gamma P. It's to be interpreted in the right way. It's just that I want to focus today somehow on the prime 3 and I don't want to deal with other primes. Maybe we can talk about it later, but there are versions of this for other primes. You can do that. But at the first place, if you first look at it, you get a Hilbert modular form at this point. Does that answer? Got it, thanks. Okay. So I want to say, what has that all got to do with topology? Oh, I just want to mention one more thing to the Hirzebruch theorem. It is actually more precise than I'm writing it. They tell you exactly what modular forms are coming up. But it tells you also that if you look, just a look at codes, well, rationally, you even hit the generators up to a multiple. But this multiple tells you that is not true non-rationally. And we really look today at the case where we are interested in integral statements, not in rational statements, really. I come back to this problem later, okay? Now, what is the link here to topology? I would say everything fits into the picture of Whitehead towers, and I like to explain that. So let me start with the orthogonal groups, by which I mean just the self-isometries of R to the N. In there, this is not connected, it has a connected component, which is SON, so matrices of determinant 1. And we know that spin N is defined as the universal cover, so as one connected cover of SON. It sits over SON with fiber Z-mode 2. You can also look at the arithmetic writer tower, by which I mean you can look at matrices which have int entries, the integers. Now you can ask, what is it here? An orthogonal matrix which has integral coefficients. Well, we can only think of permutation matrices and maybe diagonal matrices with plus and minus one on the diagonal. In fact, this is actually the same. This is plus minus one to the n semi-direct product with the sigma n. And again, you can look at those matrices with determinant one, which I call SONZ, and look at the Z-mod 2 extension, meaning I can take here the pullback of this diagram. I'm not sure if this really is the notation in the literature or if ever anybody considers this. I want to call it spin and Z, just taking the Z-mod 2 extension given by this pullback. Now it turns out that the symmetric hoop is very hard to get the hands on. The papers about it. It's related to the homotopy groups of the spheres. It's sigma infinity, if you go to infinity, right? So it's related to that. I like to look at only diagonal matrices at the moment. And I like to think of this factor of diagonal matrices plus minus one to the n as f. This is f2 to the n, obviously. Okay. And again, we have the even part, those with only evenly many minus one on the diagonally. And we have the Z-mod 2 extension given by this pullback. Now, this pullback here, this Fn, is actually well known. This is definitely in the literature. Some people call this the Clifford group. You can write it down in terms of generators and relations, and you see these are exactly the Clifford relation. In fact, you get the Clifford algebra. Can you still read this, Doug? If I write here?
Yes.
Thank you for complaining, just tell me. You get the Clifford algebra by taking the group ring. Actually, the twisted group ring. Oh, I think it's on the next slide. It's on the next slide even, right? You get the Clifford algebra by taking the group ring and dividing out the minus one in the real numbers with the minus one, which I had here one of the generators. So in particular, if you look at algebra representations of your Clifford algebra, they correspond exactly to the representations of this finite group Fn, where the central element, minus one, is acting non-trivially. And of course, now, what has that got to do with the codes? Where are the codes? Well, the codes lie in here. Well, you say, okay, that's an F2 to the N, and the code is a subset, it's a binary code, which sits in there, if you like. But what does it help? It does help you. For example, if you look at representation theory, I will give you an example here. I want to look at the most interesting representations of the Clifford algebra, the Spinor representation. And I will produce it in dimension 8 for you. I don't understand the question. I don't know what the Heisenberg group is. We will come to the Heisenberg stuff later, but sorry for that. Oh yeah, it's an extra special two group. I also considered, thank you, Gregory, also considered, for example, by Dan Quillen. And that's right, yeah. So Quillen wrote down the cohomology and everything, right? It's an extra special two group. I want to show you how to produce the Spinor representation in dimension 8 from the Hamming code. So the Hamming code sits, as we said, in F2 to the 8. But the fact that it is doubly even tells you that it comes with a section in this diagram. So this is just the pullback. I'm sorry, I didn't say it. H tilde is just the pullback. If I don't write anything down, it's a pullback. You can produce a section in this thing over in the CMOD2 extension over H. And you get the spinor representation by just inducing up. So you take a representation of H tilde. This is just an elementary two-group, an abelian two-group. It's very easy to write down representations. They are only one-dimensional, of course. So take one. Take one where minus one is acting non-trivially and induce it up to the Clifford group. That is the spinor representation. It's really hidden. It's a hidden observation in the book of Presley and Siegel. They don't talk about codes and Hamming codes, but if you rewrite it, it's an observation I think that the relation to codes is actually new, but everything here in this context is well understood, I should say. Okay, you guys, you talk this out with extra special groups. Yes, I want to go actually one step up in this picture, in this arithmetic Whitehead tower picture, and talk about the string group. So here on the right-hand side, you can see our old picture of spin n. And if you kill the lowest homotopy group, which sits in dimension, turns out in dimension 3, and which you see, you get the string group. There are very nice models for this as a topological group. For example, there is a model of Stefan Stolz, who wrote it as some subgroup of some automorphism of the principal bundle sitting here over spin and R. Yes, this is a very explicit and very nice model. There are also two group models by Christopher Chambard-Priest and other people for this string group. I'm sorry, KZ2, by this I mean just the second Eilenberg-MacLane space with coefficients in Z. Another word for it would be CP infinity, or if you like, it's the unitary group of a Hilbert space and you divide out by S1 with a projective unitary Hilbert group or something. You can do the same picture now, right? Everywhere is a pullback, and there appears now a group which I like to call string NZ. And I have a question, should N be large enough? Yes, at least not too small, like at least, I guess, somewhere I need probably five. Five is good. Thank you. Five, I like five. Five is good, probably. Maybe six to be on the safe side, but something, yeah? Okay. I like to call string NZ to be defined the thing which is the pullback in this diagram. And now you can do the same picture over F2 to the N and ask, can you say anything about representations of this question mark group, of this finite string group? It's not really finite because you have here a KZ2 extension. By the way, let me mention that maybe KZ2 is too big. It might be that you are fine with a KZ mod 24-1 extension, just because the third algebraic K theory of the orthogonal groups of the integers is given by Z mod 48, right? But I don't want to talk about this. So we want to study now representations of this question mark group. There are papers surrounding it, also by Nora Ganter and some other people in this context to try to do some aspects of it. Right. Where am I? Sorry. But one can ask, if one has a code in here, does it now lift to this question mark group? Let me also talk about not only binary group, but also, let's also look at the complex case for a brief moment. So we also talk about the groups U and C, by which I mean the isometries of the complex numbers. So well, then you have SUNC sitting over it and as three connected, and then you have SUN. If you kill the lowest homotopy group there, then it's two connected, right? If you in pi three, you have the Z, and if you kill the lowest homotopy group, there you get something. Some people call that the complex string group. Other call it U five or something. Right? You get some extension of SUNC by this projective unitary group, and you can do the same thing on the arithmetic side. For example, what is this here really? So now you look only at entries which have. Look at matrices which have coefficients in the Eisenstein integers. So what is that? You have again matrices, diagonal matrices, plus minus zeta I, and you have the symmetric group. You can figure out that this is the same. And again, I want to get rid of the symmetric group and think of Fn, Fp to the n as the powers of your root of unity. Okay, again, you get a group here, which I denoted by question mark, which is not well understood. And we like to understand its representations by looking at codes in here. Now, there is one trick that people like to do. They take the group space everywhere. So, for example, if you take the loop space of SU tilde sitting over loops of SU, then you have an extension by loops of KZ2, loops of PUH, which is a circle. It's a KZ1, it's a circle. So that's the trick. So you only have to deal now with an extension which is compact. Lee, which is good, which you understand. However, on the arithmetic part, that doesn't make sense. We only have, at this point, you only have points here. So you will not get anything if you take the loop space here. But there's a trick. And I want to tell you what the trick is. Take the lattice. Remember, let me write L0 for the lattice P. Let me write L1 for the lattice O. And we decided that we have an exact sequence, L0, Fp. Oh, this p to the n, maybe, to the n, yes. Okay, so Fp to the n is the quotient, but there's another way to look at it. This really continues this fiber sequence by taking here b of L0 and b of L1, by which I mean the lattice tensor S1, or this one, tensor S1. This is the torus. Let me call that T0 and that T1. So I can think also of Fp to the n as maps between tori, as fiber of vibration of maps between tori. And for this tori, it makes sense to talk about loops. So what also happens is that this map here actually factors over T0. So T0 also comes with that extension, and we can look at the twisted tori. So instead of looking at representations of Fp to the n, I can also look at representations of T0. I will talk about it in a moment. Stefan, one second. So instead of looking at representations of Fp to the n, or maybe this question mark group, I could look at the twisted torus and look at representations where the S1 action, or better right now, the KZ2 action is non-trivial. Or you look at loop representations of this twisted tori with S1 acting non-trivial. Now I have to look at the question. The string group has its bottom group in dimension 7. Oh, are you sure about KZ2? This is
I think those were older.
The questions related to an earlier discussion.
Okay, it's over, right? I don't have to answer them anymore.
Yeah, I think there were comments more than.
Great. I mean, I'm trying to sell here's a picture here. A picture. Oh, I didn't make a twist here. I want to relate loop representations of a loop on this twisted torus, Pn, tensor S1, as a representation of this question mark group. There are several ways to do this, to write down a model for loops of this twisted torus. And one is due to Borschütz, at least that is how I understand it. So I'm talking here about a Lie algebra model of this twisted loop group. Well, I don't need a zero, it's just for any lattice L, for example, for this Eisenstein ID lattice. So what he does is he looks at L tensor C, and you can think of this as, this is just the Lie algebra of T, of this torus, right? So this L tensor S1 and Lie algebra complexified tangent bundle would be now L tensor C. And he defines the Heisenberg algebra. I will not look at this if they say all, I will not look at it, right? Is that the deal, Nito?
You already answered the question.
Oh, great.
This slide.
Ah, I'll just go on, yeah?
Well, yes,
I don't have more time. So this is like taking loops. Think of this as a map from the pointed complex numbers into H. And we want the extension of T, of loops T, right? So we have really here to put in an extension by S1 in terms of Lie algebra, another copy of C. And K is just, so this is the extension, so to speak. K is just a formal variable. Now the Lie algebra of T, T is an abelian group, so the bracket here is zero, but the extended group is not abelian, so you have to write down a bracket. And what he defines is this bracket. You have to check, and let's believe that for a moment, that this bracket really gives you an interesting extension, the one that you look for with the string group. All right, so that's our model already of the Lie algebra of loops of T tilde. And if you look at representations, you can also just look at algebra representation of the universal developing algebra. He's making it somewhat smaller because he's not interested, like a homotopy theorist, he's not interested in loops which go over the whole complex line, which are holomorphic, and so to speak. Yeah, these are not interesting. So he's dividing these things out. I didn't write on what H plus is. H hat plus is the sum over N plus minus, maybe, positive H tensor T to the N, Z to the N, Z to the N. So he's dividing something out to make the thing somewhat simpler and calls this the vertex operator algebra of the lattice L. Now you say, well, it's just an algebra. It is more. It has more structure. It's not just this algebra. Yeah, in fact, this algebra structure is only fit in the vertex operator algebra structure. But it's not enough to talk about all the structure of the loop space. The loop space has more structure. If you think about it, you can, for example, reparameterize loops, right? That's an action already. This should be visible somehow also here in algebra. And it comes here with the structure of conformal vertex operator algebra. It comes with many products, with a product from VL tensor VL into VL. And there's a whole power series in plus minus Z. Or if you put it on the other side, it's a map from VL into int VL power series in plus minus Z. Some people call this the state field correspondence. And then it should have some properties. I should say this has been around for a long time. And I think the marketing of vertex operator algebra wasn't really good. They didn't do a good job. It's really a definition which, here's a definition, by the way. It's a definition which is not really very intuitive and motivating. There are people who try to give different description of what a vertex operator algebra is. Like, for example, Wang and Lepofsky, they described it in terms of the operation of an operator, at least a partial operation. It's not everywhere defined. Later, Chris and some others, forget the name, Horsch and Piotr, right? They did an action of a co-action of a co-operator, but that was also not the final answer. There is a Bible in this context. Some people call it the Bible. It's a book of Behlings and Trinfeld and Behlings, and very, very famous book on chiral algebras, which is much more general, but which is very motivating, if you like, very conceptual. And it was very recently used by Victor Katz, last year. He published a paper and was able to give the precise relation to vertex operator algebra using operators again. And so there's really an operator behind it. I should also say that I'm working with Lazarev, with Andrei Lazarev. We are able actually to write it down as a product. There is a product, but you have to leave the category of vector spaces and deal with topological vector spaces. You use the work of Katz and Trinfeld and Behlingsen for that. But it's really something which, I mean, this is the right definition. I don't have any doubts about it. You probably see that later, that is the right definition. It's a nice theory behind it. There are very big books about it nowadays, and they're very well written, I think. But it's just, I think the definition needs to get some work to make it more accessible and more digestible. What about some kind of holomorphic factorization algebra? That's right, yeah, but I would say this factorization algebra doesn't have a very precise or not well developed, I think so, description of representations, which I want to come to now. There is, I think, a one-to-one correspondence. Partial. Where's the partial? Oh, the D up there. Oh, this is the del is given. Del is German. It's called del. Partial is the derivative with respect to Z. The D is not, by the way, it's not. It's not important because you can get it out of Y by applying U2 to 1, for example, and let it operate. That's just the D. So D is not really important. In our case, Vn is given by multiplication in this algebra by V tensor T to the n. So very simple, it's all very explicit. And it's also well known what is a module over vertex operator algebra, so a representation of that. It's just the same thing in terms of this state field correspondence Y. So let's V act on M, just meaning you have a map Y, M, V maps to end M and many of them. They should have the obvious properties, including maybe some finite dimensional properties. I think I have to go on to get something new. Yeah, that's probably what I said. VL modules for even lattices. Right, so that's what I said. It is well understood what the irreducible representations are of vertex operator algebras, at least if they come from even lattices. The irreducible representations, by which I mean the representations which do not contain a proper submodule, are given, are indexed by the quotient L dual divided by L. L lies in L dual just because it's an even lattice. And if you take the quotients, they label the irreducible representations. And they are defined in the same way as the ones that I've written down. They're actually constructed from them. You can do the same construction as before, except that we don't have a lattice anymore. It's a shifted lattice, but this shifting really takes place in the dual lattice, so you're not far away from your original construction. And these objects, these representations, come to you with a certain function. There's an invariant associated to it. It's called the partition function, which you get by looking at the action of a certain operator L0. I didn't talk about it. I said before, it's a conformal vertex operator algebra. That means it comes with a particular vector, a conformal vector, which is responsible for the action of the Virasoro algebra. And this vector, in its one mode, it's the action of L0. And if you look at decompose this thing with respect to this action into eigen spaces and count them, then you get to this partition function. But in our case, this happens to be simply the theta function. It's just the theta function of this shifted lattice. It's not the lattice that we had before, it's a shifted lattice, but it's the same construction, except of this funny factor in front of it. Oops, this factor. This is given, this is the Weierstrass eta function, which comes up here in this calculation. Here's the theorem of Dong. Dong tells us that all irreducible representations are given by this VL plus lambda, this shifted, they are themselves, by the way, vertex operator algebras. And you get a complete list by this. Now let's go back to the case that we had before. We take the Eisenstein lattice, we take its dual lattice, which happens to be just the Eisenstein integers, O to the D, just a little calculation. And if you take the quotients, we decided before already, you have here, if you take the quotient, you just get Fp to the D. So it's the full code here, if you like. I like to look at the representation module, or is even a ring, representation ring of Vp to the D under the outer product, really. Pd times Pd prime is Pd plus D prime, right? Okay, what I mean is probably, this is the sum over all D's, so sum over all lambda in C, in this quotient Fp to the D, and then you take a copy of O. I like to invert P for a moment, for reasons which come up later. But actually, you don't have to in this definition. And then you have this lattice L plus the shifted lattice and the vertex operator algebra to it, which is a module over Vd. Okay, so let's just do it. This is an O here. And here's a theorem. So far only at the prime 3. It turns out that if you do that, then this representation ring up to the automorphism, this monomial transformation of that full code, is exactly the ring of integral modular forms. So this is modular forms, gamma 3 modular forms over O. One of the three is inverted. And the map is given by the partition function, while you have to put in this extra factor to get the equivalence. I should say this is not really a big theorem. It's also not in print yet because it's not finished. It's just that we take the calculation of van der Geer and Hitzebruch and also the theorem of Dong and do some calculations with Q expansions and theta series, and then you see it's really the same. It's not really hard. But I think it's important. It's just the angle that you look at it is probably, I think it's new. Let me go back to the codes 1 second to see the correspondence. If you have now a ternary code H, then you can sum up all these irreducible representations given by the words in the code. For every word in the code, you have an irreducible representation, VL plus lambda. And so you see here, one second, Nito. This appears to be a chiral WZV type theory based on the code. Which one do you think, Nito?
What should, yes, MH, but it's really not for topologists, this question.
Not for me, for example. That's good.
Unless you call yourself a physicist. For you as...
No, I'm a beginner for coding theories, if you like. MH, I mean, you sum up all these words, and what you get is a representation. This is something you were asking before. Remember, I was trying to sell you these representations as representations of the question mark group. In the early beginning, we were talking about representations of the Clifford algebra, and then we were talking about this finite string group sitting over it. And I said, well, let's look at representations of this. And we decided to go to the vertex operator algebras and say, look at representations of these. Well, we do get now a correspondence. If we do have a code, which is nice, we get a nice representation. Why do we get a nice representation? For example, if we have a self-dual code, I've written down one in dimension four, complex dimension four, so dimension eight, really. Then this code really, this one with the ternary code, this really maps to E4, for example, the fourth Eisenstein series. You get a nice modular form. You get an SLT2Z modular form. Actually, you can show you get a topological modular form, which is even a refinement. You can watch on the left-hand side the action of SL2F3 coming up in terms of representations. And that has to do with topological modular forms. Quotients by out means invariance. No, I mean co-invariance. I divide it out. I should talk about gamma 3 topological modular forms. I already wrote something here. In old days, people called this ELL and put in an index gamma 3. That was about 30 years ago. Nowadays, they write TMF3 for it. I don't know who started doing this. I know that people didn't like the notation ELL. Oh, I don't have much time. I should go on. TMF has as coefficients exactly this integral modular form if you invert delta. And there's also, by the way, a connective version where you don't have to invert delta. It is a complex-oriented cohomology theory. It has a genus meaning for complex manifold. And this genus is given by the formal chi-y genus on the loop space, which I have written down here in formulas. The xi's are the usual Schirm roots, which you probably also have seen in the first talk by Fei Han. And you can also write it as a twisted chi-y genus, twisted by this big vector bundle. T is a tangent bundle, T star is its dual, and S is a symmetric algebra, and lambda is a exterior algebra. And
yes, there's an interesting question. There's a question before you proceed.
Is it okay if I talk a little bit longer? Then?
Sure, sure.
Can you do it for me in... Personally.
Yeah, so the question is, when you say topological modular form, do you mean the image in homotopy from TMF to modular forms, or do you mean a distinguished lift to the homotopy of TMF?
So the TMF 3 maps to, I'm sorry, now TMF maps to TMF 3, and also the coefficients mapped in here. Now let me see. Then you also have the modular forms with respect to gamma 3, they are the same up to, let's say, delta inverted. And you have the modular forms without level structures over the integers. Everything is integral, or at least over O. And TMF3 maps to these. Let's see, that maps to this, and that maps to this, and is isomorphism. Now, when I'm saying I not only have a modular form with, or I call this MF3, I'm sorry. I not only have something in, oops. I'm not only having something in here, it lives to something here. That's what I said here, and it's even better. It lifts to something up here. And this map is well understood. It's an refinement. So not every integral modular form is a TMF, a topological modular form. For example, E4 is one. E6 is not, but 2 times E6 is. Delta is not, but delta to the 24 is, and 24 times delta is. This map is well understood. It forgets, of course, all the torsion. I'm sorry, somebody was asking questions, more questions. I interrupted you. I didn't. Actually, let me say that. You can really use this information that this is a modular form in coding theory. We now have a Max Planck Institute in Bochum for coding theory. I'm happy to communicate with them. It has some constraints, so some codes cannot exist. Not only with respect to dimension, of course, only dimension 8 and so on, but there has to be more words with a certain length and so on. You can use that information in coding theory. It has practical meanings, and I'm very happy about that. Does it answer your question? I'm not sure. Probably not.
There are no questions at this time. You can continue.
Let me just say the real theory, TMF, is related to TMF3. Well, it's getting dark here right now because, sorry. TMF3, by taking homotopy fixed points, homotopy fixed points with respect to the action I was talking about of SL2F3. And let me also say there is an S1 equivalent. Let me also say there's a theorem of Tamanoy, a very big book, lecture note series, beginning of 2000 or maybe even older. He argues that the S1 equivalent index of the twisted Dolbeau operator should be a module over some vertex operator algebra. It's now a corollary of that theorem. Everything is because it is a modular form, an integral gamma 3 modular form, it is a module over some vertex operator algebra by the theorem. It is surjective. There's a one-to-one correspondence, which I like. Maybe I should go back to the theorem. It's telling us that we can think of modular forms as something which has geometry. It is a representation of something which even has automorphism and everything. A modular form is a modular form, it's just a function. So which is good, I hope. Why is it good? Well, also we have here the theorem of Malikov, Schechtman, and Feindrup available. They constructed, later Cheng, Pockmann-Cheng did it for probably this case. They constructed a sheaf of vertex operator algebra, okay, with a differential. And this sheaf is not really a vector bundle. It's not a module over the structure sheaf, but it has an associated gradient, which is a vector bundle. And the vector bundle you have seen before, it's the one you twist with. The way I like to think about it, I probably write more above here, is, oh, there's something called the elliptic character map. It's a map from TMF3 into K-Tate, by which I mean K is power series in Q, maybe Q is inverted even. Or Rex. And this vector bundle here really happens to be the Euler class of K-Tate for complex manifolds. This is the same. And the way I like to think of this MSV of X, I like to think of this as an element in TMF of 3 of X, which is the Euler class with respect to TMF3 of X. It maps under the character map to the Tate Euler class. I think this is very reasonable, and it would be very nice to have a description of TMF3 in terms of this. And you also would get then an equivariant version. There's a recent paper by Leon and Linshaw, which does this construction equivalently. Oh, I want to mention this MSV had very nice applications. There are these famous results of Borisov and Liebgober. I think he should be here on Miller symmetry using this sheaf. However, to construct this sheaf, you usually have to talk about vertex algebraids, which is even worse than vertex algebras. So one should really work on the definitions. So that's something we do at the moment. We hope that we can write down TMF3, the cohomology in terms of sheaves of vertex operator algebras, which are modules over other sheaves. And I can be more precise about it. If you give me, do I have a few more minutes? Or
it's around 10 o'clock. I think it's okay if you take a couple more minutes.
Okay, maybe I should do this to stop. One more slide. I'm trying to write down what an elliptic object is in terms of vertex operator algebras, what I think it is. Remember the definition of Borchardt's, the construction of a vertex operator algebra with respect to a lattice. There you had a C here in this point, but you could think of replacing C by C infinity function on open subset, say, of a manifold. And having here some action, which you don't want to specify at the moment. And you get a vertex operator algebra if you do that. And we could define something which is the sort of vector bundle for K-theory, the analogous thing for elliptic cohomology. We could define it as a sheaf of modules which locally have this form, which are locally modules of this thing that I've written down. Then it turns out, and that's something that we can show, that MSV is one of these objects, and we get the right object if you put U to be a point. If you put U to be a point, we had this theorem earlier that you get exactly the right coefficients for your cohomology theory. And we also have the analogy to K-theory. K-theory is made out of representations of the Clifford algebra. And TMF should be made of, that's what I'm saying, representations of this question mark group. And that's what it is at this point. If you do it, if you do what, well, at least vaguely, that's the analogy. You could try to look at bundles with fiber modules over this vertex operator algebra and do this construction, and you get a cohomology theory for sure. I checked that. And you get a complex orient one, and you get one with coefficients modular forms. However, it's still not the right one. You don't have the right orientation. It's K theory tensored up with modular forms. That's the cohomology that you get if you do that construction. You need to have MSV of X to be an object in it. Then you have the right Euler class, and having the right, if you have a cohomology theory with these coefficients, with these Euler classes, MSV of X, it has to be TMF3. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Gerd. And maybe we could give Gerd a round of applause.
Thanks. Bye.
We've asked a lot of questions, but I'm sure we can ask some more. So Gert, I got a question for you. Can you hear me, Gert?
I can hear you.
Yeah, so this VDU that you've constructed, one of the problems, if I'm not wrong, is that this no longer has a nice category of modules. I think it's not rational. So I don't think that the, you know, the L dual mod L will give you the collection of modules, and that's because you've now made it non-rational by throwing in the C infinity, unless you sort of incorporate that in it somehow. And I could be wrong with what I'm saying. I think others can.
Yeah, you're right. I actually do incorporate it in. I don't really look at, you need to say what a module, a sheaf module is, so to speak. What do I mean by it? And I really like to tensor just up the one without having more modules, tensor this thing up with a module over the point. That's what I mean. I'm not very precise here about what I mean with a sheaf of sheaf modules or something.
Can I just ask about the some sort of TMF orientability condition? I mean, my memory of the chiral Durham stuff is that you only get a kind of global conformal structure on a chiral complex if you have some kind of P1 equals zero condition. Do you understand how to make that work?
I understand what you mean. I'm not talking about the Witten orientation at the moment. If you want to have the Witten orientation, then you really need some extra condition like pi 1 half has to vanish. However, if you do just the elliptic genus, right, which is a complex genus, you are fine without any restriction having a complex structure. So that if you have two copies of the same thing and they the condition pi 1 equals 0 cancels out. You can read it up in the paper of Hoffman Schenk. He's worked it out very nicely. There's no further condition needed.
Sorry, which paper?
Hoffman Schenk did work it out very nicely.
Uh-huh.
About 2010.
Okay.
But for this specific genus, nothing else further is needed. It's like if you have two copies, the pi one should agree in the two copies, and they cancel out each other, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a comment more than a question, if that's allowed, which is that, if my memory is correct, I think Hopkins in one of his ICM addresses shows that the theta series of any unimodular, even lattice, already lifts to TMF. And I'm wondering if you use the same sort of, I mean, I guess the question is kind of comparing your theorem a couple slides back with that. His argument used a quite non-trivial result of Borchardt's about theta series of lattices and their coefficients.
That's right. I'm just talking about his theorem. This is really not an observation of mine. I'm referring to exactly this result here of Mike
okay.
Hopkins. It's really a result of Mike Hopkins, that you get okay. a topological modular form. This is also not written here as a theorem. It's just the fact that you have unimodular lattice, a self-dual lattice, and then you get a topological. It's just a calculation, a fixed point spectral screen. It has nothing to do with vertex operator algebras in this point. And yeah, that's okay. That calculation is enough for that. But it's nice to see actually the action coming up on both sides. You can make it very explicit, the action of SL23 coming up on the left-hand side too.
Mm-hmm.
On the representations.
So should we think about this as an example of a situation where you know how to attach a topological modular form to something which is not a sigma module?
Something which is not what?
Meaning, is this the topological modular form that should be attached by to the quantum field theory?
Oh, I'm not talking about quantum field theory, really. As you can see, you can represent.
But you're talking about the vertex algebra, right? Which is a quantum field theory.
Yeah, okay.
The holomorphic vertex algebra is a quantum field theory. So,
okay.
What do you mean, okay?
Yeah, then so, it is, right? Everything is a field theory, if you like.
Not everything, but a self-dual, you know, a vertex algebra with whose category of modules is vect is a quantum field theory.
So let me say it once more. Nice representations give you nice modular forms. These are ones which come even from TMF. That's the result here. I'm not sure about quantum field theories. I'm sorry. Maybe somebody else can say something about quantum field theories. I know that this vertex operator are related to these quantum field theories, but I'm not. I haven't looked at it very closely, so I cannot answer the question. Sorry.
I mean, it was not a mathematical question at this point because clearly the definition of quantum field theory is not sharp. But I was just wondering if there is any sense in which this is the TMF class attached to the quantum field theory associated to this vertex algebra.
So, Davide, I think that is the content of what Mike Hopkins may have been saying, going back to Theo's question. I think Mike Hopkins claimed at one point that if you start off with a self-dual lattice, then that gives you a canonical class in TMF. And so if there is any if there's any dictionary that takes a field theory or a holomorphic field theory to TMF, then it must take this self-dual lattice to that class. I think that is the philosophy.
Does the weight work out? I assume it does, just because.
Yeah, it works out.
But because I mean, as far as I understand Mike's construction, that is not an explicit construction of a TMF class. He just calculates what the image is. So he argues, hey, we understand the image of TMF into modular forms. So this is not a construction of a TMF class.
But as in far this, as I know. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions for Gareth? Well, then thank you, Gareth, for this very interesting combination of topology and in vertex algebra as well. Thank you once more. I'll just thank Gareth.